Chapter 14. Thought comes first, and thought can be controlled. Hasty people are sometimes accused of speaking and acting without thinking. The accusation is untrue, or at least it is an exaggeration. Men often speak and act with insufficient thought, as for instance, those who make this exaggerated accusation, but there is always thought of a kind before any speech or deed of a normal human being. We need not stay to discuss whether the subconscious impulses, which in abnormal conditions may produce unreasonable speech or action, can be dignified with the name of thought. We will not try to appear learned by plunging into the obscurities of advanced psychology. We will only take note of some simple truths which any normal man may find in himself. We have a profound conviction that the study of psychology is valuable just on this elementary and obvious ground, while most of the ideas thrown up from the advanced field beyond are of doubtful truth and still more doubtful virtue. It is unfortunate that even the simplest of truths have been clouded in the dust of controversy. There is no subject in which there has been a more complete illustration of the law that extremes beget extremes. There are men who claim that the human will is so potent that it can bend all things to itself. And there are men, on the other hand, who deny that we have any free will. There are some who have exaggerated the mysteries of the subconscious mind, and there are others who are prepared to deny that there is a subconscious mind at all. Atheists usually deny the freedom of the human will. It is doubtless a logical result of their negative doctrine of materialism. It is peculiarly incongruous that some who have made this denial have, at the same time, describe themselves as free thinkers. This is all indicative of confused thought, which may easily lead to fruitless and destructive strife. The argument of the strict materialist has been based, presumably, upon the idea that even mental processes are mechanical. It has been maintained that the action of the will has only been through intensified desire. Even the conflict between inclination and duty has been represented as a mechanical clashing between different desires, with the certainty that the strongest would win and result in action. There may be a sense in which such a conception of the meaning of desire may be true, but the subject has often been presented in a way that is unreasonable as it is unchristian. It should be remembered that when a sympathetic observer of human troubles undertakes a defense of the bottom dog on these lines, he is setting up an equally good defense of the top dog. If all men are the slaves of chance and circumstance, then it is true that the wastrel cannot help being a wastrel, but neither can the tyrant help being a tyrant. In that case, it would be folly to blame either. But then, of course, the one who blames and scolds cannot help himself either. The possibilities of farce are endless with such a conception of the mind. We can imagine the precocious boy who has read some of this negative teaching putting up a defense for his breach of decorum. He explains to his guardian that he is the slave of heredity and environment, and that consequently he is not to be blamed for his misdemeanor. As we can imagine the guardian listening gravely and rather grimly to the defense, and then as he reaches for the leather strap, explaining that while the argument is perfectly correct, and the boy is not in any way to be blamed, he himself is equally helpless and quite unable to resist the temptation to administer the soundest of thrashings. If I am the slave of conflicting desires, and forced with mechanical precision to yield to the strongest of them, who am I to experience these soul conflicts, or to have desires running counter to the natural inclinations of the flesh? If the answer is that I am only part of the blind forces that enslave me, or that I am the sum total of all the material clashings, the subject becomes confusion, worse, confounded. We are simply bound to postulate a certain freedom of the will, and a reality of human personality or clear thought becomes impossible. As a wise man remarked many years ago, it is easy for anyone to argue against the freedom of the will, but we all know in ourselves that we possess it. Much harm has been wrought by extremists in this, as in all other subjects. We have actually heard a normally intelligent man, in revolt against the excesses of psychologists, deny the very existence of a subconscious part of the mind. Poor fellow, if all his mental impressions were in his conscious mind at the same moment, of course he would be hopelessly insane. It is certain that he did not really mean what he said. Every intelligent human being who will reflect for a few minutes will agree that the greater part of the mind is beneath the plane of consciousness. The complicated movements of muscles when we walk is subconscious. The still more complex movements of lips and tongue in speaking are so distinctly remote from the conscious plane that one who has not studied the subject is totally unable to describe how the commonest of words are pronounced until he experiments and takes careful note of how it is done. If an audience is challenged to describe how a well-known word is pronounced, it is amusing to note the movement of many lips as all who are interested frame the word and, in effect, ask their lips and tongue how the sound is framed. A man may have 12,000 words or more in his vocabulary, but he may be very thankful that they are not all in his conscious mind at the same moment. If he is a fluent speaker, he can usually bring up each word as he wants it. And in the course of a public address, there is a constant stream of words coming up from the subconscious part of the mind and passing back to it again after the thought has been expressed. Sometimes a speaker will temporarily forget the word or the name that he wants. Almost all people are subject to such occasional lapses. Some suffer frequently. In such an event, we say that we cannot call the thought or word to mind. It is, of course, in the mind all the time, but it is in the subconscious part, and for some reason we cannot bring it to the plane of consciousness. It is possible in this connection to experience a very curious sensation. A thought that we had desired to express has slipped from us. We try to remember what it was, but at first without avail. Then suddenly, we become conscious that it is coming. We cannot explain why we know, for we have not yet laid hold of it, but for some undefinable reason, we are certain that the lost thought is returning to the plane of consciousness. In another second, we have it, and feel that it was foolish ever to have forgotten. Hidden away in the subconscious, there are many vague feelings and impressions, as well as definite memories. Sometimes these feelings may be stirred in a manner that reason fails to analyze. The feelings may even be so complex and unreasonable as to be a serious menace to mental stability. Then it is helpful to know how such subconscious entanglements may arise. When an unreasonable feeling of depression, or horror, or anger, or fear has been traced to its cause, the work of overcoming it becomes much easier. As was pointed out in the previous chapter, the more fully we are aware of our mental condition, the better will be our balance and the more effective our work. Every man may be conscious of these several parts of his mind. There is the observatory, containing the delicate instruments that keep him in touch with the outside world. There is the workroom, where the messages recorded are compared and judgments are formed. And there is the great storehouse, where impressions and ideas of all kinds and in all stages of development are kept ready for future use. Presiding over all is the ego, as it has been called, aware of the various influences and, in measure, aware of the mental processes, able to encourage or to inhibit, able to decide, to will, and to put the muscles in action. Able, in fact, to make use of all the lower parts of both mind and body. As the psalmist expressed it, we are indeed fearfully and wonderfully made. An intelligent man is always aware of these elementary truths regarding his mind. Even if he argues against the existence of the will, as men sometimes do in spite of their intelligence, he is all the while acting counter to his arguments. He really accepts as a fundamental axiom of life the fact that he is a responsible human being, coming in contact with other responsible beings. When a man is not accounted responsible, it is because of some defect or a diseased condition of the mind that makes him abnormal. There's a lack of coordination between the various parts that prevents the exercise of judgment and will. Such a man is not responsible. In other words, he is not sane. As a matter of fact, it is only when we take this view of life that it becomes possible to make an effective defense of the unfortunate. A man who was hungry and whose children were hungry has stolen bread. Another man, who is in no such need, has been gambling with trust funds in the hope of making a fortune. Both have breached the law, but the circumstances are very different. The first had the best of excuses. The other had no excuse at all. If, however, we took the materialistic view, as it had been advanced by some writers, we should have to excuse them both on the grounds that they are equally the slaves of circumstances which has determined their action. Let us thrust aside this unreal, speculative argument and deal with facts as we experience them in ourselves. With a little of such introspection, we soon become conscious of a most interesting truth which at once reveals the weakness and the strength of the human will. We may have an important decision to make, and we are conscious of influences pro and con. We can, if we like, delay the final decision, and during the interval of waiting, we can bring under review the various factors that will influence our determination. We are conscious that we can inhibit some thoughts and encourage others. We can, if we will, call up feeling to assist, or it may be to subvert, the reason. Sometimes men try to work up feelings of anger or indignation to assist them in carrying out a part that would not be approved by cold reason. Others have chosen a better part, working up a feeling of courage and enthusiasm to help them in the performance of difficult duties. Thoughts and feelings act and react on each other. It is literally true, as stated in the book of Proverbs, "As he thinketh in his heart, so is he." There may be times when we are confronted with an issue calling for no skill of judgment, but for much force of will. Duty points definitely in a certain direction, but inclination pulls quite as distinctly the other way. We are fully aware that no amount of argument can really affect the matter. If we give way to inclination, we shall realize, perhaps more distinctly than ever, what our duty really was. We shall be sorry, perhaps even bitterly repentant, for the error into which we have fallen. Yet inclination is so strong that we may be tempted in the moment of weakness to accept the materialistic doctrine of determinism and put in the feeble plea that we cannot help ourselves. In such a crisis, we may make the discovery that while we are not strong enough to overcome by a single effort of the will, we can find a mental process that will give us ample strength for the hour of need. There is an interval between the first contemplation of the problem and the final time for action, just as there was in the experience of the Savior, when the Spirit was given to him without measure, and he knew exactly what he had to face. He was driven of the Spirit into the wilderness, and there he faced in the wilderness vision the trials that so soon were to come in daily experience. And he set his face like a flint, that that he should not be ashamed in the work that he had come to perform. So much depends on how we fill up the interval, especially in the matter of what we think. What thoughts shall we encourage and cultivate? What thoughts shall we check in their inception? These minor points of decision are comparatively easy, but they make all the difference when the time comes for action. They build up reserves of power that seem so natural and inevitable when we use them that we perhaps fail to realize that they are the product of those sound thoughts that required little effort of will in their simple beginnings. When nearing the time for momentous action, the worst possible thought is to hover over the forbidden and contemplate the attractions of the thing we desire to avoid. The best kind of thought is positive, constructive, and vital. Be not overcome of evil, says the apostle, but overcome evil with good. Again he says, whatsoever things are true, honest, just, pure, lovely, and of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. It is as if a man wishes to move a heavy weight, but protests that he is not strong enough. We point out to him that, although a direct exercise of his strength may be inadequate, there are means ready to hand that will endow him with the necessary power. There is a block of wood that will serve as a fulcrum, and nearby is a bar for a lever. If he is in earnest in his desire to move the weight, he will soon take the necessary steps to apply the aids when they are pointed out to him. Apart from such leverage, all the desire in the world would leave him still impotent. We see illustrations of this principle every day. No reasonable man expects to attain to honorable position in mortal life without going through the necessary process of training. It seems only just that if his desire for success is so slight that he will not take the little successive steps that lead to the coveted position, he shall fail. The same thought was expressed by Christ in connection with the ultimate hopes of man. Are there few that be saved? The disciples asked. He answered, strive to enter in at the strait gate. For many, I say unto you, shall seek to enter in, and shall not be able. The Greek word here rendered strive is the one from whence we get the word agony. The word rendered seek is defined by Dr. Strong as meaning to seek, desire, require, question. Many may seek to enter in the questioning spirit of the half-hearted philosopher, desiring to be on the right side if there should prove to be any stability in the Christian hopes. Christ requires his disciples to agonize after the manner of those who competed in the Olympic Games, cutting off everything that hinders and calling forth all their powers in concentrated effort. Apart from the prize he seeks, the athlete may find that the effort is worthwhile in the sense of physical fitness and strength. A sense of spiritual conquest and mental stability would be 1,000 times more worthwhile, even apart from the gift of eternal life. When a man knows of simple means for gaining strength and does not use them, it surely indicates that he does not really desire to be strong. If a man makes no effort to overcome evil by the exercise of strengthening thought, it indicates that his desire to avoid the evil is not very sincere. We are reminded of an amusing story illustrating this point. The little boy had been forbidden to bathe one fine Sunday. He transgressed, but protested that he really had meant to obey, but when he saw the river, it looked so tempting that he could not resist it. But, said the mother, if you really meant to obey, why did you take your swimming costume and towel with you when you went out? Oh, he stammered, I took them in case I might be tempted. The Apostle Paul says, "Put ye on the Lord Jesus, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof." If we make provision, we shall soon find occasion for use. Thought comes first, and as with every kind of growth, the younger it is, the easier it is to guide. If we have a genuine desire to live Christian lives, we must begin with Christian thoughts. Very often, in human experience, the toleration and sometimes even the encouragement of wrong thought has led to such evil feelings and deeds that in the latter stages, the plea of the materialist might be true. The sinner is not responsible for his actions. In other words, he is not quite sane. If he had taken wrong thoughts in hand earlier, he might, with some difficulty, have stopped the evil growth. If he had dealt with them at the very inception, he might have guided them aright quite easily. Herein is the best possible benefit of this teaching. Some readers may be wise enough to profit by it early in life. They may perhaps see some positive evidence that it has helped them, but they will never know of all the pitfalls from which it has saved them. The Apostle Peter makes use of a fine phrase, based upon Eastern customs of dress, but still quite intelligible to the men of the West. "Gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope to the end." Dress seems almost part of a human being, and flowing robes add to human dignity. When there is work to be done, however, the robes need to be controlled and kept in place. The modern Christian, who would keep ahead of pagan chariots and lead erring souls back to the field where good seed is sown, must gird up the loins of his mind and run, as the prophet Elijah ran, before the chariot of Ahab from Mount Carmel to the gates of Jezreel. Undesirable thoughts must be inhibited, idle thoughts dismissed, good thoughts and feelings encouraged and developed. He must make the choice while choice is easy, and use the little thoughts that can be controlled to build up and direct the big thoughts that are so much harder to turn from an established course. Girding up the loins of the mind implies a gathering together of all parts of the mentality, a concentration of forces, a use of the lower part of the brain to establish the final object of the will. Well-trained habits become most helpful servants. Ill-trained habits become tyrant masters. In the most literal sense, it is true that, "As a man thinketh, so shall he be." We are aware that many thoughts flit into the conscious mind, unbidden, and perhaps even undesired. They may be presented to us through the senses, or they may be thrown up from the great store of memory. We cannot prevent this fleeting presentation, even of evil thoughts, but we are perfectly conscious that we are able to make our selection of which thoughts to encourage and which to reject. We can, at any moment, call for a halt in the idle stream of consciousness, and fix the spotlight of attention upon something that is worthy. We can call forth other thoughts and seek for new knowledge to nourish the chosen idea, thus making it grow, and most effectively, crowding out the undesirable. The tragic truth is that most of us fail to realize properly that thought is real. Yet in one sense, it is the only reality. It precedes and causes action, and it remains after the action is over. A man may indulge in evil thought, supposing that it is only a thought and of no importance. It may be only a thought, but in the final issue, it is the man himself. The true Christian realizes his responsibility. He knows that he is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lusts and enticed. He would never be so foolish as to reproach the Creator or protest that he cannot help his action. He knows that ample provision is made for him to develop his character, and that the selection of the right daily exercise and the right daily thought is relatively easy. The true Christian must be an optimist, because he is confident that there is a final object in the existence of humanity. Although all flesh and blood is destined to perish, the thoughts of God are eternal, and God will restore from the human scrap heap all that is worth restoring. The true Christian is anxious to find all the daily helps that will bring him into harmony with the divine. He will understand the apostolic exhortation in all its force and beauty, and he will, perhaps, know how to translate the thought into action, and action back again into still deeper thought. Gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope unto the end. The same ideal is still more definitely expressed by the Apostle Paul, bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.